The market doesn't joke around, so why would you? Get serious. Choose Tastytrade. Tastytrade gives you the tools you need to make smarter moves. Dig into data with advanced charting, track profit accurately with order chain trackers, see risk clearly with curve analysis, and trade with low-capped commissions, stocks, options, futures, and more. All on one platform. No wonder serious traders choose Tastytrade. Join the club, genius. Tasty Trading is a registered broker-dealer and member of FINRA and SIPC.
Live from the Nasdaq Market Site overlooking New York City's Times Square, this is Fast Money. I'm Melissa Lear. Traders on the desk are Tim Seymour, Brian Kelly, Mark Tepper, and Dan Nathan. Another Monday meltdown as rate shock hits stocks. All three major averages finishing the day deep in the red. Coming up, you'll hear from one long-term bull who says he is now the most bearish he has been in a very long time. Also ahead, a pulse check on the consumer, the three key events coming down the pike that will tell us if the U.S. consumer is alive and well. Plus, a bold call on Bitcoin. One Wall Street firm says the cryptocurrency is about to break out the magic number they are putting on Bitcoin right now. But we begin with another tough day on Wall Street. Stocks hitting the skids as yields headed south, just adding to Wall Street's wall of worry. Goldman Sachs, Morgan Stanley, UBS, Bank of America all out with new notes, raising the red flag on trade tensions hitting the market. So what do we make of all this, this sort of, I don't know, stuttering in the markets based on trade?
Well, it's interesting that you're getting some of the macro folks around the street starting to become a little bit more concerned, when in fact I do think that we've seen bond yields telling us something very dramatic. So 164 we close in the 10-year, dollar holding in, but I think the concern around the rest of the world truly that we're seeing some major contraction. If you couple the PMIs we've had over the last couple weeks, we've got regional Fed surveys this week, we've got a CPI number in the States, which I do think that the Fed will be closely watching to at least give them something to follow through behind in terms of inflation or lack thereof, giving them more cover. Look, the bond market is concerning. When you look at European banks trade down 8.5% over seven sessions, and you can make an argument that the real structural problems in the global economy exist in Europe, not in China, that's reason to be concerned.
Yeah. Well, I think it's interesting. It wasn't but a fortnight ago everybody was concerned about. That's 2 weeks to you guys on the metric system. But it was 2 weeks ago that we were worried about the Federal Reserve not cutting rates enough. Now, all of a sudden, we've got bond yields at lows and everybody's concerned about a recession that's out there. Now, I do think that there's some justification to this concern about this global slowdown because it's continuing to go on. To me, what's going on in this market right now is people are pricing in a prolonged trade war that goes on past the election, and that's going to drag on growth, and it's going to drag on growth globally, and then it's hitting the hot spots, Europe being one of them, Japan banks being another one of them, certainly China, and then Hong Kong.
I mean, within that fortnight span,
yes.
BK,
yep.
We got the additional
10%
tariff tweet.
Right.
We got also some weak data out of Europe, and so that all adds up to those mounting global concerns.
Yeah, I mean, there's huge global concerns. And quite frankly, you know, I was really convinced that we were going to have some sort of a trade deal done by the end of this year. I thought Trump was slow playing this thing. He wanted to get a couple rate cuts in before he signed off on any trade deal. And the way I'm feeling right now is now China is in a position of strength. They have the ability to slow play this all the way through the election next year. And we might not even get a trade deal at that point. So, you know, trade matters for manufacturing. Manufacturing matters for profits, and profits matter for jobs and capex. So, you know, it's all an issue right now.
Yeah, and I guess the big issue, if you're watching this show because you care about the stock market, is that the S&P 500 is basically flat year over year. Last August, it was trading at very similar levels, and we have a situation where we're seeing one step up and two steps and sometimes three steps back as far as what the ability is for the S&P 500 to make some real progress here. So we talked about last week some of these incremental new highs that we've seen since January of 2018. The real problem that I see is that every time you want to try to buy that breakout, you get a flush lower. We've had a 7%. We've had a 12%, and we've had a 20%. Now, there's been great trading opportunities to buy those lows, but the longer this goes on and the longer these issues are existing as far as what we're seeing in other risk assets, most notably yields, the risks of buying those lows increase fairly dramatically. It's just that simple.
I think you're right. The question is there a headline out there that gets you to change that view, Dan? And we've been in a place where the trade headlines have been enough. Obviously, the Fed has been a major supporter. If you think what got us really to the highs after that June low was set June 3rd, it was really probably the Fed. Mm-hmm. But we have had enough headline support where the question ultimately is the market now becoming completely inured to any of that? And are we too late? And CEOs didn't tell us in 2Q earnings season that they were necessarily they were not pessimistic enough.
Yeah, but,
and that could be a concern.
But we've seen this time and time again. Think back the last 20 years when we've seen this build up in the late 90s into early 2000. I mean, the CEOs were the last ones to call it. In the build up to the 2007-2008 market top, the Fed were the last ones to call it. The bank CEOs were the last ones to call it. That's not really their job.
That's fair. But in the meltdown that we saw at the end of last year, we did have earnings season as sort of, they did call it early. Remember, we started getting those warnings
early on,
and that sort of preceded.
Well, hold on. We also had a government shutdown that was looming. Listen, let me tell you what's going on in 2019 right now.
You do
the
that.
World is becoming
Come
a
on.
Bit unhinged in all different facets when you think about it. Look at what's going on in yields globally. We've never seen this in the history of the planet. Look what's going on politically, okay, in Hong Kong. We're going to talk about it's becoming a little dangerous. Think about all the issues that we have related to climate change and stuff like that. It's feeling a bit unhinged. I'm just saying. So the one thing that's not unhinged right now is the S&P 500.
The tree huggers are now involved.
And that's the
danger. Wow. Okay. But here's the thing. You're saying the one thing that's not unhinged is the S&P 500. So that, to me, is what makes it more dangerous. We're not that far off the highs. Every other asset class out there, every other risk asset class is telling you that there is something wrong in the world, yet the S&P 500 is still lingering near its high. So I actually think there's more to go on the downside here, whether there's global warming or you enjoy driving your SUV.
Is there a little part in you, Tim, that thinks that you know, all these firms are finally throwing into the towel, raising the red flag, and maybe that's
sure.
a sign of the bottom?
There's a contrarian in me that sees that. There's also, I think, positioning, which we've talked about. You can debate how real time it is, but when I look at hedge fund positioning, but more importantly, I look at kind of overall investor positioning, I do think that the bearishness that's out there right now, and certainly that's taken place quickly in the last week, is enough to make me say, hey, look, we're going to grow 2% in this quarter. I realize things can change in a hurry. Dan brings up a lot of relevant historic moments in time where people didn't see the whistling past the graveyard, or in fact, they were doing such. But everything we heard out of corporate America is a lot of caution on global trade, but nobody saying, you know, my business is falling apart here. And I just, while I don't think CEOs have necessarily always the ability to forecast the future, they have no reason to be Pollyanna here. And I don't think they were.
All right. Well, one long-term bull says growing trade tensions have him the most bearish he has been in a very long time. Let's bring in Jonathan Golub, Chief U.S. Equity Strategist at Credit Suisse. Jonathan, great to have you back. What caused you to turn so bearish?
Well, I mean, and I think that you, Dan, hit the point. We are flat for the last year. And if you get away from the gyrations that we have a great 6 months, really on the back of unwinding the fourth quarter, markets don't move forward when you have a meaningful deceleration in global data, period. And the second thing is, we want to believe that lower rates are good. When you have rates go from 3.25 to 160 and change on the 10-year, that the market's telling you that there's something wrong. So what do I want to see? I want to see interest rates level off and start to rise. I want to see the cyclical data get better. And we hit our year-end target about 3 or 4 weeks ago with 30.25. Everyone was asking, are you going to push it forward? Do you think it's going to go up? I said, listen, I think that this thing is going to take a breather for a while. And right now, I think that's the case. Longer term, we're not going into recession. There's a lot that's wrong. I don't think we're going over a cliff. But I wouldn't be buying. And by the way, in December, I was screaming, buy into the volatility. I'm not making a comment now.
Do you think yields are going to go a lot lower? And I'm asking you this because so many people are saying, oh, you know, I can see yields going down to 135 to test the prior low, or I can see yields go to 125 or even 1 or whatever. But I don't see a recession on the horizon. And I'm just wondering, what exactly then is the 10-year telegraphing when we go from that high level to 164?
Right. The Fed has inverted the short end of the curve. And until the Fed comes out and says that we are going to fix that, the interest rate is going to keep getting pushed lower until, and it's not whether they do one more or two more. The Fed needs to say, we will not allow the short end of the curve to be inverted. Because what it means is people, instead of investing longer term, are just going to roll one month paper over, and it drains liquidity out of the system and it puts the system at risk. There's a reason why the market hates to see an inverted curve, because it is a problem. So if the Fed gets religion on that, I think that interest rates will rise, the curve will steepen, and I think it'll be good for markets. It won't. You need. There's really two stories, though, that and the cyclical data.
So, OK, so that's actually, I'm glad you brought up cyclical data again, because nobody thought that yields could go down here. Now that we're down here, everybody says they're going to zero. What happens is the sequencing important. So do we need to get good cyclical data and then yields rise? Or can the yield can yields rise and give us a signal that things are getting better?
It's a great point. But I think that if the Fed were to let you know that they're actually this data dependence means that they're day trading the economic data like we are. No, what they need to say is we are going to fix the curve. That we ultimately, and you can't have the futures market saying they're going to move 3.5 and them saying, well, we'll see how it goes. And so if they get religion on that, I'll tell you right now, the 10-year is going to move up and bond investors are going to lose money. Short of that, I think it's going to continue to be here or lower.
What is religion in the context of the reality of Jerome Powell? Is it 50 basis points in September?
Right now, there's almost no acknowledgement that the short end of the curve is being inverted because they're holding the overnight rate way too high. And so it does. They don't need to say we're doing 3 or we're doing 4. What they need to say is this is an important part of our objective. If we believe
we're going to defend this.
Well, it's not a defense, but if we want to see growth in the economy, we can't have an inverted short end of the curve. And that's important to us. Mm-hmm. If they say that tomorrow, I'll tell you right now, you're going to get a pop in yields, and they don't need to move at all. So I mean, eventually, but in the near term, they don't need to.
I'd like to forget the Fed for a second, because I actually think that the market's an atheist right now. The market doesn't believe the Fed. I think the Fed's rendered itself irrelevant. Your stock picker, your strategist, in this environment where we stay at 165 or we go to 135, there's certainly been some sectors that have outperformed and have traded, and there's been multiple expansion here. So where is it?
Well, I mean, I kind of think about the market as having three buckets. You have a growth bucket, and how many growth stocks in the S&P 500? 35 of them. It's a really narrow list. Right. You have these stable, relatively low growth companies that you have in utilities and telcos and staples, and people can't believe that the PE is so high on them. But these are bond proxies. But the S&P 1.9 dividend yield and the 10-year is 30 basis points lower. Anything which smells like a bond is too cheap, and they're going to keep going up as long as you have this environment. And then anything that looks remotely cyclical until that data turns is a dog, and I would stay away from it.
Hey, Jonathan, what would it take for you to feel more confident or have more clarity on 2020 earnings?
Well, so here, let's take a look at what's going on right now. The revenues are fine. Revenues are growing at 3 or 4%, not an issue. The buybacks are strong, and you have a margin issue around three issues. You got a dollar problem, you have an oil problem, and you have a big tech margin problem. And ultimately, though, the average company, the median company in the S&P, looks pretty darn healthy. Next year, I think, you know, if we assume that the dollar goes away as a headwind in oil and some of these big tech issues go away, I think we'll be surprised. But the market's not paying attention to the earnings story right now. It's all this other stuff.
Have you ratcheted your target down further?
We haven't.
What are you waiting for?
Or what would it take?
What would it take for me to?
You're the most bearish you've been in however long.
Yeah, I mean, so here's my optimism or why I have it. If we look out 18 months, and we were talking before about what's the upside case? The yield on the S&P dividends and buybacks is like 3.8. The S&P is so cheap compared to bonds that when you get investors buying stocks for yield instead of bonds for yield, I think ultimately the valuation of the market has to go up, but you have to wait. And listen, if you said to me 2-3 years out or 18 months out, sure. I just don't know how much longer the cyclical data is going to stay weak, and I don't have to be early on this one. But if you said to me a year and a half from now, the stock market's going to be higher than this.
All right. Jonathan, good to see you. Thank
good
you,
to see
Jonathan
you.
Golub of Credit Suisse. What do you think about this TINA valuation for the market?
Well, it does make sense. And I mean, when you think about it, I think the yield thing came into play really hard when we saw this dramatic drop in the 10-year so quickly. Bubbles get created all the time because of this. We know that the staples are going to be really, really expensive, trading at 25 times, no growth, all that sort of thing. I guess the concern for me is that when you talk about the market right here, we just didn't have the confirmation of the new highs. We had a new high, a new all-time high in the S&P 500 last month, and we did not see the AGA of MAGA. We only saw Microsoft. You didn't have Apple. You didn't have Google. And you didn't have Amazon.
AGA of MAGA.
Yeah.
So MAGA,
the AGA MAGA.
Minus.
You didn't have small caps. You didn't have industrials make highs. You didn't have the banks. And you say to yourself, what the heck is going on here? Because it doesn't look like a whole lot, heck of a lot of broad strikes, in my opinion.
Can we, I think, just cut to the chase here? If you listen to the conversation on the desk tonight and you listen to what the new strategists are saying, if you removed this sense of that there was massive black swan systemic risk in the world, wouldn't stocks be a buy here? I mean,
what do you mean by black swans?
My sense is people look at Hong Kong, they look at unprecedented territory.
You would still have slowing global growth.
People are of the view, not that equities are falling apart because earnings are falling apart because the U.S. economy is going straight downhill. They're looking at these other factors and they're assuming there is a black swan on the horizon, not looking at fundamentals as they are right now.
All right. We're just getting started here on Fast Money. Up next, a bullish bet on Bitcoin, the one Wall Street bank that sees more than 20% upside for the cryptocurrency. We'll break down that call ahead. And later, a pulse check on the consumer, the one chart that says the American shopper might not be doing as well as everyone thinks. We'll explain. We're live from Times Square in New York City. Much more Fast Money right after this.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
Welcome back to Fast Money. We are following a developing story out of Argentina. The peso plunging against the dollar after the country's center-right leader had a poor showing in primary elections last night. The political pressure, not only the latest in a string of issues facing Argentina, the economy is still struggling, unemployment and poverty rates climbing, and a host of other pains for the South American country. So, Tim, what do you think?
Well, the bigger issue for the peso is, are you starting to see what was looking like reformist governments that were taking hold again in Latin America? Again, this is about 10 years after the last time, or maybe 15. But Macri's losing in the primaries was devastating. It was a major shock. And then that bleeds into Brazil. Brazil, in currency terms, in dollar terms, was down about 3.5% today. And the sense that also in Brazil, you had actually seen the pendulum. This is what happens. It goes back and forth. At least it has in the last 15 years. Mm-hmm. So the question is, we're actually getting to a more leftist, non-democratic environment over there. That's terrible. The bottom line is emerging markets so far have been pretty well contained in all this madness outside of what's been going on in China. If you start to see the currencies break down, and again, I'll just bring up the chart of the Brazilian real, somewhere around here over the last couple of days, you started to see this thing break where it looks like it could head straight to four. EM has been a problem where crises have spread to in the past that have not started there, and that is something that people are looking at right now.
It's not even as if things are that great under Macri so far, right? I mean, inflation has been skyrocketing, but the alternative, Fernandez and Kirchner, I mean, if you take a look at what Kirchner did before, right, currency controls, a multi-year standoff with bondholders, out of the capital
market. So that's why the peso moved 15%, mm-hmm. which is a massive move for a currency, just as well as bonds fell apart. So, you know, this is everybody priced in today the fact there are going to be capital controls. And they actually started pricing in the fact that Argentina might default on a bond in 2021. So, I mean, that's what the market's thinking. To Tim's point, though, the real play.
You've seen that movie before, though, right?
Huh? I mean, the real play, as you pointed out, is does this spread to other emerging markets? Argentina on itself is probably not big enough to impact the U.S. markets or anything else, but if it starts to have that contagion effect, that's where it becomes a problem.
Yeah, I mean, hopefully it doesn't have that contagion effect, but, you know, from my perspective, Argentina does a lot of things really well, right? They've got great red wine, they've got great steak, tango. But then they also have runaway inflation.
Tango? You have a tango game?
I've done it before. Yeah. It's a lot of fun.
That makes the next
I'm not that good at it, but, you know, it's a good time. So, inflation was up 55% last year. I mean, that's absolutely crazy. They've defaulted on debt time and time again. Their currency is down, you know, big time against the dollar. I think the dollar's appreciated 300%. Versus the peso over the course of the last 3 years. So just not a place I'd want to have any money right now.
All right. Well, whenever we talk about currency instability or potential devaluation, mm-hmm. we think of Bitcoin, of course. And today, Goldman Sachs had a big call on Bitcoin saying that Bitcoin will run 23% higher in the short term with an even bigger potential down the road. And that run would take Bitcoin right to around 14,000 in the short term. So what do you think of that call?
So I like the call, but I am a bit concerned about the Bitcoin market. So I do think we actually have one more leg. And generally in Bitcoin and other commodities, kind of this last leg of the rally is usually a pretty big, powerful trade. What concerns me about Bitcoin right now is we're not seeing the address growth. So the reason why I look at that is because that's fundamentals. That's new money coming into it. So we really need to see that address growth. What's been going on, Bitcoin's been trading right with gold for the first time since I started talking about it in 2013. Macro players and other investors are actually using Bitcoin as a currency hedge. So that's starting to happen, but it's pure speculation. We need to see some buyers come in, some real buyers.
So Beeks, it seems like that Bitcoin has just kind of owned the entire crypto asset space in the last year and a half or something. Are you seeing this massive shift? Because this move has been really substantial. And the fact, one of the bull cases, I kind of think back to 17, I can't even remember what they were, but it was, other than momentum, was that it was uncorrelated to traditional risk assets. So are we seeing that play out? Is that why we're seeing the ability for this move to kind of stay put because macro players are trading it?
This is the perfect storm for Bitcoin. You have multiple currencies around the world breaking down at the same time that institutional investors are actually embracing this asset class. So the combination of those two things have funneled all the money into Bitcoin. That's why Bitcoin's outperformed so much in this environment.
It look at gold. And so I don't want to take the focus off of Bitcoin, but I do think that the original Bitcoin was gold. And if you look at the break of 1500 today, and for someone that for the 2.5 year resistance we kept running into around 1350 to 1400, definitely wrong there. And now it's time to go the other direction. There's no question that the market is using gold as that proxy. 1700 will certainly be challenged. And if you like gold, you probably like silver more, because on a relative value of the gold silver index, it's massively outperformed and silver is underperformed.
All right, well, you can read more about Bitcoin on our website, fastmoney.cnbc.com. I'm Melissa Lee. You're watching Fast Money on CNBC. Here's what else is coming up on the show.
The big gamble. Tensions on the rise in Hong Kong. How will it impact gaming revenues in neighboring Macau? We're rolling the dice on China ahead. But first, the cannabis countdown. A pair of pot stocks putting out results this week. We'll break down what you can expect from Tilray and Canopy Growth when Fast Money returns.
This episode is brought to you by AARP. 10 years from today, Lisa Schneider will trade in her office job to become the leader of a pack of dogs. As the owner of her own dog rescue, that is. A second act made possible by the reskilling courses Lisa's taking now with AARP to help make sure her income lives as long as she does. And she can finally run with the big dogs. And the small dogs, who just think they're big dogs. That's why the younger you are, the more you need AARP. Learn more at aarp.org/skills.
CNBC has quick and easy to understand business news updates at the open, midday, and close every weekday. Markets, money, and more from Wall Street to Main Street. I'm CNBC's Jessica Ettinger. Follow and listen to CNBC Business News Updates wherever you get your podcasts.
Welcome back to Fast Money. It's a huge week for the consumer retailers like Macy's, Walmart, and Tapestry, all reporting results this week. We also get a slew of economic data, including the Consumer Price Index, retail sales, and consumer sentiment. But with trade tensions heating up, the consumer could get crunched. Macy's CEO Jeff Gennette telling our own Courtney Reagan last quarter, if tariffs are levied on the remaining $300 billion worth of goods, which looks like is happening now, it could, quote, really impact our categories. It's not in guidance. And when you do the math, it is hard to find a path through that would not impact customers. So with that said, now that we know the tariffs are coming, what do you think of retail?
I don't like retail for that exact reason. The one thing that retailers have been doing across the board is they've been absorbing some of these tariffs and they've been keeping prices low. China's actually kept prices low, but now it's getting to a point where you can absorb 5%, 10%. But a 25% tariffs, if we start to go 10% to 25%, that becomes a real problem. Prices start to rise and sales are going to go down. So any of the ones like Walmart, that chart looks terrible. Any of those names that have exposure to that, to me, are just no touches.
So I think there's certain pockets of opportunities within retail. So one of the companies we like is TJ Maxx, right? So let Kohl's and Macy's, they can pay the tariffs on all these goods that are coming in. They're not going to sell them. Those goods are then going to end up over at TJ Maxx, and they will sell them because people love going there for that treasure hunt experience. Beyond that, I think there's also an opportunity in companies like Lulu. I mean, that's a Canadian-based company, not going to be hit by the tariffs. strong brand loyalty. I mean, I was just on vacation in California. All my girls wanted to do was go to the Lulu store, right? So, I mean, if people go there, they continue to buy it. Even if prices go up, they're going to continue to spend money there.
There's also retail. I mean, you're making the point earlier that they're sort of the staple retailer, yeah, which is doing okay. And then there are the department stores, which are not going to be able to weather the tariffs very well.
Yeah, so, I mean, listen, we don't even have to talk about the XRT. It's year after year for the last 5 years, one of the worst charts of all the sectors of the market. It's a disaster. You know, the issue about some of these big box guys like Walmart and Target and Costco is their margins are really narrow. I mean, like, so that's a big issue. That being said, I'd rather be there. Just one other point I think it's really important to think about. When rates, we're just spending a lot of time talking about rates. What are we seeing in autos? What are we seeing in home sales? We're seeing them down year over year. So when you start thinking about where is the strength of this consumer that 70% of our GDP is on, I just don't see it in the same light. I mean,
I just think the operating margin in Walmart has been priced to perfection. I think there's going to be pressure there. And I think if you look at us at Best Buy, that's a name always trades cheap. Guess what? They are the ones, to me, that are in the greatest line of fire, yeah, from this trade war.
Let's turn to the charts. Consumer staples and discretionary, they've been among the S&P 500's best performing sectors in 2019. But despite the gains, the chart master says there are plenty of potholes on Main Street. Carter's over at the Plasma. Hey, Carter.
Hi, guys. Well, that's just it. There are potholes, and there's also what is perceived to be and really what is. And so one of the perceptions is that consumer discretion as a sector has been a great performer. And the reality is, of course, it's absolutely not a great performer. Let's try to unpack it. So two lines, blue and orange. The blue, this is since January of 18, so 18 months plus, up about 15%. And that's essentially double, if you look back at the axis there, the market. Market's up 7. The sector is up 15. So you say, so what's the problem? Now, it's always ever thus. It's a few names holding up the group, keeping everything alive. If you make the equal weight sector, let's add it in. So now all I've simply done is taken the blue line and not given Amazon the weight that it has in Home Depot and others, but made them all equal weight. 62 stocks, almost $3 trillion. And what we know is actually it's a big old goose egg. In fact, the sector itself up 15, equal weight unchanged, actually down a fraction. That's the real story of consumer, and it's what Dan was talking about with XRT. It's been with us a while, but it continues, and that's kind of the issue. So now here, removing the S&P, here are the two, the actual and then the equal. And one could say, so what? But the actual is the actual. But it makes it that much harder to outperform because you had to be in just a handful of names. In fact, and we can talk about this later, five names are half the weight of the sector. So a couple other ways to draw the lines. This is going back the same time frame. And what we know is that the equal weight sector, right, and its relative performance, and this is the problem, consumer discretion, equal weight relative to the actual is making new 2- and 3- and 4-year relative lows. Now, compare it to the S&P. Here's the equal weight on top, and it's the same thing, making new, fresh 52-week lows, despite the belief that the sector is outperforming. Pull this back even further. Here it is. We're approaching the 09 low. All of this for nothing, meaning the relative performance has collapsed. We're getting back to crisis lows. And let's look at the two popular ETFs. This is the ETF, the weighted one. And what we know, there's no way around this, is that we're hovering, and the risk is that we break. And then, of course, here's the XRT, the disaster, and it's the same thing, just in a different form. It's a well-established downtrend. You can draw the lines and circles, and it all suggests more to come. Not good.
Carter, come on over. Jonah will bring the chair over. Thank you, Jonah. So many questions for Carter today, right?
A lot of questions.
I have a few. Yeah.
You want to kick it off?
Yeah.
Kick it off.
Why not?
Well, first of all, welcome.
Thank you.
I guess my view is, while those charts don't inspire a lot of excitement, but the discretionary chart relative to Jan 2018, when all markets, when the U.S. market, the S&P at the all-time high, that blew off top, it looks marginally better. And that would be an XLY. And that would be one which, again, includes a big boy like an Amazon or something that you're talking about. But is that a disaster? It seems like it's just performing in line, we're really talking about relative performance.
Right. So I guess there's two ways. It's the circumstance where just a few names, in fact, five names, right, are worth half the weight. So 62 stocks, but five, and you know the names, it's Amazon, it's Home Depot, it's Nike, it's McDonald's and Starbucks, are basically carrying the day. And now one could say, wait a minute, so what? Macy's been going down for 5 years. JCPenney's been going. You're always going to sift out the winners and losers in life, and that these are the ones that should. But more and more money in fewer and fewer names is a circumstance that almost always ends badly, and that is the problem.
Sure.
So that means that the winners in the XRT, the five names that make up half the weight, are also going to be losers?
Well, ultimately, if you think about the circumstance of bifurcation, it's good technique. People say, I'm going to stay away from the things aren't working, and it's musical chairs, and I'm going to go and stay in higher and higher ground. At some point, you just get to be a valuation issue. You just get to be a money flow issue, and we have to be very close to that point.
So, Carter, I'm curious. You come on week after week, you talk about these equal weighted, and you're saying there's only this narrow bunch of stocks that are working, and you go sector by sector, and it happens to be in every sector.
You guys are talking about industrials with financials.
Yeah. Right. So at what point does that become a huge problem for the market as a whole?
Well, that's just it. You have fewer and fewer.
You just fed him a softball, Matt.
What do you mean? I'm wondering if there's precedent for this.
Dan was pounding on this just earlier. It is a circumstance that makes sense because as technique goes, you want to try to favor winners, but at some point it's just too much money pressing in on too few names, or guess what? It gets down to the fundamentals. At some point, they're expensive.
Has this been going on, though, for a long time?
It goes on and then it ebbs and it goes on and then it ebbs. And again, that's
so where
the natural
are we now
bias
in the ebb and flow
of markets. But it's particularly, poignant now, right? And it shows how fragile. It's a circumstance of fragility.
I want to ask you about the overall indices since we saw this sell-off in today's session. In your note this morning, you said June lows were in play.
I think so.
I mean, 2022 or so?
Sure, you can do that. I mean, in the afternoon, you know. But the point is that there's a breath issue, and that's one of the reasons why you'll never hear me talk about advanced decline line. That is a concomitant index. It is a coincident index. What really matters is the structure of the market. The structure of the market is a lot of extended names and more weak names, and that bifurcation usually ends with generally lower prices.
Okay. Beyond 2022, though?
I think so.
Beyond?
Oh, sure.
Why to not? What, though?
Why not tap it as the December lows and then some?
December lows.
Sure, why not? We're ultimately, unless you don't believe there'll ever be a recession again and the business cycle continues. I mean, if things were so good and rates were, you hear about the Fed model and my DCF and all the stuff that people, and you inverse the peak, well, then stocks should be surging. We should have 30 times PE. Where are the buyers? Something's wrong.
Carter, thank you.
Thank you.
Mr. Sunshine here. Carter Braxton-Ward.
Boy, you made some good points, though.
December lows.
Yeah, I would just make one point. I mean, so think about it. So farmers got the hardest hit, right, from this first round of tariffs that went in through last year. So now we're really starting to focus on the consumer here. So farmers got a bailout. Farmers got this really nice socialist chunk of cash that our manufacturers, right, we're paying for these tariffs, and then they got the money. So then pretty soon, consumers, they're going to need a bailout, right? And we bailed out consumers before. So if we keep ratcheting up these tariffs, are consumers going to get a bailout? And what do you think that means if we're just have these tariffs on 600 billion? Well, wait.
Tax cuts.
Well, first of all,
the
I would be more worried
higher,
about corporate America.
Yields actually have to go to zero and below. I mean, this is how it all starts.
If anything, the place where there's an issue when slow growth, the first place you're going to stop is actually that triple B tranche of debt that will very quickly turn to junk, some of it, if you get a lower growth environment. So the falling angels is a dynamic. But back to your S&P, look, 2825 is the 50-week moving average. There's very good support there. Does not mean that has to hold. And in fact, your next spot is probably 27 and a quarter.
All right. Coming up, more on today's sell-off. We're drilling down on the tech wreck. One options trader just made a $2 million bet that tech's troubles are just getting started. We got the details ahead. And later, Hong Kong on high alert as massive protests intensify. The one sector that could get hit hard as demonstrators dig in. Stay with us. Fast Money's back after this quick break. Welcome back to Fast Money. Pot stocks getting put to the test this week as key names like Tilray and Canopy Growth kick off earnings. Let's get to Aditi Roy with more on what to expect. Hey, Aditi.
Hey, Melissa, and both those companies have very different tasks at hand with those earnings. One factor favoring top line growth at both companies, Canadian adult use sales were up 22% in April and 15% in May, month over month, as more stores opened in the country. It'll be a lot tougher for those companies to blame friction in the space for lagging sales revenue. You may remember last quarter, Canopy Growth reported a decline in revenue from gross adult use and medical cannabis sales in Canada. Tilray will likely be talking about domestic sales in Canada, but also pointing to international investments. The company just announced it is increasing its cultivation capacity in Portugal. We'll see if that folds into the guidance. We'll also look for any comments on Tilray's investment in the U.S. CBD space. The company's been partnering with Authentic Brands, which is behind Nine West and Juicy Couture, among other brands. We'll see if Tilray has any color on the types of CBD products and timeline we can see those things roll out from that deal. Canopy Growth, though, has its own challenges, given that last quarter was rough. And this is the first earnings call after the ouster of co-CEO Bruce Linton. The numbers Canopy will report will reflect Linton's last quarter with the company. Mark Zekulin, who's now sole CEO, will likely set a tone of fiscal discipline, a slowdown in acquisitions, and a focus on the local market. Morgan Passia of Poseidon Asset Management also tells me he'll be watching margins for both companies, because if they're having to cut prices to get shelf space, that would have a margin impact. Melissa, back to you.
Aditi, thank you. And before we get into this trade, I want to mention that Tim has a cannabis ETF, CNBS. And for disclosure purposes, all the components are listed on our website, fast.cnbc.com. So, Tim, in terms of declines that we saw last quarter in adult-use marijuana, was that mainly because there wasn't enough supply available?
Yeah, I think there was issues in rollout. Our last segment was called Potholes on Main Street. I mean, this one could be called Potholes
in Potland.
Main Holes on Pot Street. And with what was going on in Canada, I don't think it's representative of really what you have. If anything, what we learned from Aurora and Aphria, who have already reported, they're the first two big heavyweights to have reported that actually there's been a slight surprise to the upside. Some people actually feel, first to Canopy, that, you know, we're expecting somewhere around 110 million Canadian as their top line number. Maybe there could be a little bit of weakness there. The most important thing for Canopy right now is gross margins, based upon how they came in at 16% last quarter. People want to see them up around 23%. Aditi talked about the change in leadership. Look, I think there's a major driver for this company for them to articulate exactly who is going to be taking the helm. And most likely, it's going to be someone who has a very large CPG background, which is what this company is, just like their parent in Constellation Brands. So I think Tilray is a story of many different, very interesting strategic global partnerships. She talked about the Authentic Brands. I think the Manitoba also acquisition will be one that starts to show some returns. I think, frankly, in Canada, Tilray lags badly the other big boys. So you want to see what's going on. This Portugal deal, I think, is one that's very interesting. That is playing into their distribution into Germany, which people are very excited. And let's remember that they're also partnered with Novartis, ABI. So they have these strategic partnerships by big consumer players.
Are supply concerns exacerbated by CanTrust and the finding that a second facility was not properly licensed by Health Canada?
Well, I think in the short run, the answer is I don't think we know the answer to that, but there's no question that this has been a major disruption, and the corporate governance around this is something that's given all investors pause, and it's affected all of them, even though I think different companies, and this is why you really need to do your work, folks, because corporate governance risks are a big deal. Demand in Canada, and again, this is not why you're investing in the sector, and again, 25 times EBITDA for Tilray is not a valuation that even makes sense. It's the global footprint. It's what these guys are doing in the U.S., and I think that's what people are focused on.
Coming up, escalating protests in Hong Kong threatening one big group of stocks. We'll tell you how to trade this move, plus tech, still the best performing sector this year. But one trader just made a $2 million bet that the hot rally is about to cool off. We will lay out the trade much more fast right after this. Welcome back to Fast Money. We are keeping an eye on the latest developments out of Hong Kong. Demonstrators digging in today, forcing Hong Kong to shut down its main airport. The growing protests could have major impacts on casino operators in neighboring Macau. Let's get to Contessa Brewer back at headquarters with more on this story. Contessa.
Las Vegas Sands today dropped more than 3% and down 14% month to date. Over that same time frame, Wynn has lost 18% off its share price, down 1.7% today. Hong Kong-based Melco Resorts lost 1% today, and MGM lost 1.5%. But over 3 months, it's actually up 11%. Of course, it has the least amount of exposure to and reliance on its Macau revenues. Hong Kong is a major port of entry for Macau, and a summer of protests is having an impact. Last week, we heard Wynn CEO Matt Maddox on the earnings call blame cancellation of hundreds of flights for some of the softness in that VIP segment. And that was before the entire shutdown of the airport. Gaming analyst Harry Curtis at Nomura Instinet writes today, While the protests in Hong Kong and the closing of the Hong Kong airport will likely have a negative near-term impact on visitation to Macau, the impact should be transitory and visitation should recover once the airport reopens. But of course, trade tensions and a weakening Chinese economy are also creating headwinds. Melissa?
All right, Contessa, thank you. Contessa Brewer back at headquarters. I don't know if it's just the reopening of the airport that's going to magically turn things around. I mean, we already saw the impact on just tourism in Hong Kong, and retail sales in the month of July were down 7%. So it's feeling an impact in terms of consumers' willingness to get out there and spend money.
Absolutely. I mean, the airport today, the airport closing was stunning. It reopening is going to get some trickle back, but I don't think you're going to see just this huge influx of people until this unrest is resolved. So you have a couple dates that are important. You have early September when a lot of the kids go back to school. Potentially that could be it. And it has to be resolved, in my view, by October 1, primarily because that's when China wants to celebrate their independence and they have a big holiday on October 1st. They can't have Hong Kong in unrest. That being said, a lot of this is kind of priced into these stocks. So you look at something like a Wynn. That was a $130 stock at the beginning of this month. There is going to be a buying opportunity in these names once you see some of this unrest go away.
We were talking EEM earlier as it relates to South America, but when you look at the EEM, the ETF that tracks supposedly all the emerging markets, really heavy China, Taiwan, right, South Korea. And so to me, I think that's the one that if you continue to think that this is going to play out over months, I think as kind of maybe a hedge against your U.S. portfolio, that would be a good short, in my opinion. You know, I think, 40 was a big level. I think if you go back and look at 2016, there was a double bottom low down in the low 30s. And I think that's a level that you could see this thing moving down towards. Tencent, largest holder, holding Alibaba. We know that Taiwan Semi and then Samsung, obviously. So,
yeah, no, that's a good point. I'll talk back to casinos. I'll just say that when I do think if you listen to their last round of numbers, we got information that they're basically flat year over year in terms of EBITDA. But I do think if you look at the free cash flow here, it's something that, while not an issue for the company, it is something that's really where you're starting to see the brakes being put on. Ultimately, if you look at the gamers, you know, Macau peaked in May, and it was actually at 5 months high. I think part of this is that sentiment was so strong for the sector, at least coming into this period. The final thing on Hong Kong, to me, for gamers, is back to, I think, cracking down on capital flight is really the story for Macau. That to me, at a time where China's starting to panic, whatever that means, Macau's going to suffer.
I mean, in the past, they've done things like you can only take out so much money out of an ATM, et cetera, which really hurts, somebody wants to gamble a lot.
Yeah, so when we talk about taking money out of the ATMs, gambling, I think the casinos with the VIP exposure are going to get hit the hardest. So I'd be avoiding Wynn. I do like Las Vegas Sands here. I think there's a great opportunity on the pullback. They focus more on that middle-class gamer, right? And we want exposure to the rising middle-class consumer in China. I think Las Vegas Sands a great opportunity right here.
All right, coming up, tech getting slammed in today's sell-off, and options traders are betting the pain is only just beginning. We'll break down the action. Plus, take a look at our Cramer cam. Jim is sitting down with Take-Two CEO Strauss Zelnick. Be sure to catch that full interview on Mad Money coming up at the top of the hour. We're live at the NASDAQ in Times Square. Much more fast still ahead. Welcome back to Fast Money. Tech under pressure again to kick off the week after staging a huge turnaround last week. But the options market isn't convinced that tech is out of the woods yet. One trader just made a $2 million bet that the pain may be just beginning. Dan's over at the Plaza with the action. Dan.
Yeah, so let's talk about the QQQ. That's the NASDAQ 100 ETF. And we know that 40% of that ETF of 100 stocks in the NASDAQ is really weighted towards four that make up 40%. That's MAGA, Microsoft, Apple, Google, and Amazon. Today, put volume was two times that of calls, and there was a trade right out of the gate, minutes after the market opened this morning when the ETF was trading about $185. There was a buyer of 7,000 of the November 176-157 put spreads, paying about $3.11 for that. That breaks even down 6.5% at 172.89 on November expiration. And the trader can make up to $15.89 all the way down to 157. That would be down 15% from the trading level here. And one of the things, you know, when I see a trade like this, I don't know if it's a bearish bet. Maybe it's more like a hedge against a portfolio of some mega cap tech stocks. But it's at least interesting to look at because, you know, from the chart standpoint, here's the 1 year chart here. And look at this uptrend that's been in place since the December lows. If I was Carter, I might be saying, you know, drawing a couple circles here and saying this is some pretty important support here. I just want to draw another line. This was all last year. It was this really steady uptrend, a series of higher highs and higher lows. And once it broke, we know that we had a 20% peak to trough decline. I'm not saying that's going to happen again, but I think if you live through that, you might be cognizant of the fact that it could happen again. But let's go to this chart. This is since the lows in 2016. And what I think is really interesting is that this was massive support all the way from the lows in 2016. And when it broke it last year, we had a meaningful break. But what happened here? This trend line has now, which was support, is now resistance. And in these two highs, we have failed over the last year to break out above that prior level here. So to me, you know, we did not have a confirmation of Amazon, of Apple, and of Google of the new highs in the broad market here. And that could be one reason why this thing is lagging on a relative basis. So to me, I think it does make sense when we get to these relative highs to start thinking about taking some gains in these mega caps or thinking about some cheap dollar protection in the options market.
All right, Dan, thanks for that. Dan Nathan, for more options action, check out the full show this Friday, 5:30 p.m. Eastern Time. Up next, Final Trades. Time for the Final Trade, Tim.
We talked consumer discretionary, and I do think that Best Buy runs into some problems here just below 65. The stock I would actually sell.
DK.
You know, if you don't like the new kid on the block, try the OG Gold, which is actually GLD.
I like
buy that one. Do you like NSYNC?
Yeah.
Sure. Mark Tepper.
So I like CVS here. The valuation is at rock bottom levels because of all these fears surrounding Medicare for All. Love the Aetna deal, and all they do is they just continue to beat and raise.
Dan.
Stating the obvious because that's what I do. I think retail is a bit of a disaster. The XRT is one of the worst. When it breaks 38, it's going much lower.
That does it for us. See you back here tomorrow at 5. More Fast Mad Money with Jim Cramer starts right now.
The spirit of performance defines Acura, and now it's electric. Introducing the all-electric ZDX, Acura's most powerful SUV yet. While what powers their cars may change, the energy that makes Acura never will. Crafted using the same formula that brought them electrified supercars and multiple IMSA championships, the ZDX has track-tested performance that packs an energy all its own. With a premium Bang & Olufsen sound system and up to 313-mile range on a single charge and a Type S variant with an estimated 500 horsepower, the ZDX is everything they said electric could never be. It was built with the driver in mind, just like Acura has been doing since the beginning. We could talk all day, but the only way to experience this electric performance is to drive it yourself. Unlock the energy and order yours at Acura.com.